Before we get started, a quick disclaimer. This podcast is for entertainment purposes only. Nothing you hear is an offer or a solicitation to buy or sell any investment. And with that, hello and welcome to the Rangely Capital Podcast. I'm Andrew Walker, Portfolio Manager at Rangely. And with me as always, my co-host and Rangely's founder, Chris DeMuth. Today, we're going to start by talking about some issues over at Google, and then we're going to move on to some the small cable channels that you don't really watch. You're paying for them, and that might change in the near future. So, Chris, let's start with Google. It's been kind of an interesting week for them. There's been just a ton of advertiser backlash over the past week from, stemming from them to Google displaying ads next to what they're calling inappropriate content. And this has ranged from fabricated news stories to kind of, you know, the type of really racist stuff that people, that's becoming a little bit more, I don't want to say mainstream, but that's been in the news a lot recently. And some extreme examples were terrorist recruitment videos is kind of what really broke this story open. I think it was L'Oreal, they displayed a makeup ad before a terrorist recruitment video, and somebody broke a story that said, hey, this is, that terrorist recruitment actually gets a cut of the proceeds from that ad. You're literally directly funding terrorism. We've talked a few times on the podcast about how fake news and viral tweets are a real issue today, but kind of wanted to have a little free-flowing conversation about Google's issues with displaying ads next to all of these things. So I'll turn it over to you.
The biggest case is Google and YouTube, because it is such an example of spontaneous created content. I love the idea of spontaneity, and I love the idea that society can completely organize itself horizontally. I think YouTube is a spectacular, wonderful thing. The amount of money people can make just out of things that I would never guess in theory that anybody else would have interest in, but that hundreds of thousands or millions of people have interest in, I think is great.
And we mentioned on the podcast before, like PewDiePie, I'm not sure if we mentioned this specifically, but I think he made like $20 or $30 million last year. And similar to this issue, Disney had to pull, Disney pulled their advertising from him when he made some, I believe it was some off-color anti-Semitic jokes, and Disney pulled their funding. But, you know, very much in line with this, spontaneous user-created content is very hard to control if you're doing brand advertising with it.
And we're seeing the problems of a lack of intermediary authorities. But I have to say, we've just gone through certainly a century that I'm kind of aware of, conversant in, and I imagine a lot longer, where many of our problems were with Mr. Big, the central intermediary that told you what you could or couldn't accomplish. I mean, how many creative voices said, well, I have to go sleep with the record producer or do something to get past that intermediary. Now that record producer has to kowtow to the creative people. And I think this is a hugely wonderful thing. But at the extremes, what if something is offensive? I would stipulate that offensiveness is a characteristic of the listener, not of the speaker, and that in a free society, in terms of offense, the answer for the most part should be who cares. At the extremes, I have a very different concern with some of these videos. It has nothing to do with whether or not I'm offended. It has to do with whether or not I'm endangered.
Yep.
Perspective violence is a special category, even when speech should be protected. It goes past the significance of your privilege with your lawyer and your doctor. If I say, and I'm not saying this, I'm not even going to say it because I don't want to be quoted as it, but if somebody says something about perspective violence, I think that that is more important than any concern
about
speech.
You're saying you fully support... We don't support them, but you support the right to free speech for somebody who has very controversial views. We don't support the right to free speech when it starts saying, hey, I'm going to attack this person or endanger this person's life.
That absolutely.
So I think the area, I don't think anybody's going to find that controversial. The area I kind of want to dive into is more the fake news type stories.
Yeah, that's...
Because I think that's where you're getting to the morally gray area. And my question to you is, you know, is this advertiser pushback on trying to... Because one of the things they're certainly trying to push back is not just getting removed from the terrorist videos, but not having their brands associated with this type of fake news.
Mm-hmm.
Is this pushback on fake news, is this part of the free market's way of dealing with fake news, where if there's no advertising incentive to go out and make fake news that gets a lot of views, even though the content isn't real, if there's no advertising, then there's no incentive to actually create that. So
that could be the better, more effective solution. I would think the theoretical one has really been tested and is problematic here. I would say, well, the best disinfectant is light, and that if something is a lie, then it can be battled with the truth. But the truth is often less entertaining. It is not getting as many clicks.
Yep.
It's not getting as many thumbs up, and it's a lot more subtle. I mean, I think that if you look at the content of a lot of the dishonesty, the fake news, the lies out there, it tends to be in a specific category, which I define as emotionally cathartic. It tells you, hey, Andrew, I just want to let you know everything you thought was more true than you thought it was. You were right utterly. Your enemies were wrong completely. And it's kind of a full-time celebration of the rightness and the total depravity on each side of their enemies. And so this kind of thing, you can catch it right away. I mean, I think it usually looks incredibly stupid, but it is much more popular than anybody who tries to walk it back.
No, you're right. You can catch it right away. But then my issue is, like, I'll see it and I'll want to know, like, how can someone believe something that crazy? You know, like, there was the Pizzagate fake news and all mm-hmm. that sort of stuff. Like, I'll always wonder, like, where are they getting the facts for these? And you can kind of go down a rabbit hole trying to fact check them. It's just a very strange issue.
I think that the advertisers are right. I mean, I have actually on both sides of this, with publications that I've been involved with and with companies I've been involved with on advertising, kind of ping things that I thought, oh, well, you know, this isn't about free speech. This is simply about what you want your identity to be associated with, which I'd hope and expect for most organizations is a much, much higher standard, that it just seems incongruous.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the flip side is, if you look at a lot of the kind of psychological research around where people are most susceptible to buy goods and services, it's not always positive stuff. I mean, people who are emotionally churned up can actually be more susceptible to advertising. These companies are going to want to be very careful. It's not all virtue that they want to promote.
It reminds me of the story, and I don't think we've talked about it on this podcast. I don't know if you've heard it. Target, they used to have such good data on their customers that they would know that people were pregnant kind of before they did, or yeah, before their family did, based on what they were buying. And sometimes they sent some advertisement to some guy's daughter, and he absolutely flipped out. He was like, my daughter's 16. Like, I can't believe you'd advertise this filter. But it turned out she was pregnant. He just didn't know. But, you know, the reason that people send so many advertisements when they're pregnant is it's an emotionally charged time, and people change their habits during emotionally charged times, and that is just catnip for consumer packaged goods companies and consumer goods companies to get that opportunity. And like you're saying, emotionally charged fake news is very emotionally charged. It gives them an opportunity to kind of sneak in and get them to buy something on emotion that they normally wouldn't try, spend a little extra money, try a new product. So I think you're 100% correct on that.
The world is coming to an end. And since it's coming to an end and you only have a few days left, you might as well buy my product, which you can see over here on the side.
Exactly. You know, I just want to touch real quick. So part of the story is a lot of advertisers are going to push for more metrics from Facebook and Google. They want more metrics. They want to be able to use third-party software to kind of spot check Facebook and Google's metrics. And Facebook and Google have always pushed back saying, no, we give you the metrics. They might give a little bit more, but they're not going to allow third-party software is their thing. You know, it's pretty clear, more clampdown on where you can advertise, giving more metrics, higher cost, less ad inventory. That's not great for Facebook and Google. Where do you think it kind of balances out?
These big advertisers, you know, having people on both sides, you know, you have the WPP, you have the big individual companies like P&G who are able to really push back, give them a little run for their money. I think that there's reasons to be skeptical. I'm a big proponent of the third party data gathering. It's kind of just like auditing. I mean, if it's true, they should be able to see it. And I think that there's a lot more information that can be given. And I think that the ad side of this is going to get a little more sensitivity.
Yeah, you know, I'm 100% with you there on the third-party metrics, but Facebook and Google, at this point, they control well over 50% of the market share for global advertising. They're where all the eyeballs are. They're kind of a duopoly in terms of online advertising, and they might just say to all these advertisers, like, if you don't like it, okay, walk. Like, somebody else will take it because this is clearly valuable this is clearly valuable stuff. It sells products, and if you're not going to do it, we'll just give it to someone else who will. So you can see the proof kind of in your sales, I guess, is what I'm saying. I wonder if governments are going to have to step in and say, these are two big, giant online monopolies. You know, this is probably, they're probably more powerful than Microsoft was in the 90s. I wonder if that's something that needs to be looked into at some point.
I think that Google, Facebook, Amazon, and it's interesting if you look at some of the personnel who's coming in the Justice Department more than the FTC, but senior people in this administration, I think, are going to be looking carefully at this kind of thing, whether or not I like it. These will be real issues. You know, not only a duopoly, but boy, even more so if you look at the ad budgets with really good data, I would like it to be even better. But what are they going to say? You know, go post it in the Tribune. I'd have a hard time arguing that it's just spectacularly better than it was 10 years ago, mm-hmm. or than it was before they were there. So,
all right. So I think we'll probably be talking about this in the near future. But let's move on to the small TV channels that you don't pay for. So for decades, the number of TV channels on the cable dial kept rising. You know, I think the last time I checked, my cable channel had like 150 mm-hmm. channels or something. But, you know, as consumers are kind of revolting against their cable bills and saying, like, hey, why do I need this when I can get an internet connection and Netflix? A lot of giant conglomerates are kind of rethinking their channel strategy. We're hearing a lot more about the skinnier bundles where people are to try to keep people from cord cutting, keep them to pay something for the major channels. And you're seeing a lot of conglomerates starting to cut down on those excess channels. NBC is shutting down their Esquire network. Viacom, we've talked about them a lot before. Parent company of MTV, Nickelodeon, Comedy Central. They're narrowing their focus from 24 channels to 6 core networks. And we saw some quotes that said insiders say the first thing to go are going to be excess channels like MTV Classic and, you know, like ESPN 8, the Ocho would be on the chopping block for ESPN or something. There were some stats in here that we can throw out there, but I kind of want to turn it over to you. You know, what do you think about the cutting of all these excess cable channels?
I think it's great for consumers. I think it's going to increase. My sense is not only do you have Netflix and Amazon, but you have Netflix, Amazon, and then as you have the devices at home, where people can order very specific shows. My sense culturally is somebody mentions a show and you think, oh, I'll check out that show. And I don't watch that much television, but it's dominated by friends who mention a one-off show. I couldn't even tell you, other than once I've ordered it on the introduction, what channel it was mm-hmm. on. And so most of these channels I've never seen, and the ones that I have seen. So it's going to be skinnier, more bespoke. It's going to be really hard for these cable companies to keep forcing people into dozens and dozens of channels that they don't watch.
Yeah, look, I think that's a great point. I think 150 channels was great. It gave you a lot of choice when you couldn't stream something online, because then you could say, oh, I want to watch a Friends rerun. It's always on one channel. I can probably find it somewhere. You can probably find the reruns. But when you can watch Friends anytime, why do you need a channel that's running Friends, that's built on Friends reruns? And, you know, the article mentioned that these channels that were basically rerun channels, they were insanely profitable because there's no cost there. Mm-hmm. All you do is hire a rerun, just show it on air, and if you get paid a penny or two per person who subscribes to the cable company, they were mentioning 50, 60%, these crazy types of cash flows. It's a great model, and I think it's dead.
I have a friend who was a senior officer in the first and second Gulf War, and he said in the first one, they almost never hit what they were aiming at. So you would just kind of carpet bomb an area. Mm-hmm. You just have hundreds and hundreds of things, and like one would work. But by the second, you'd almost always hit what you were aiming at. And so if you hit it once, you don't need lots and lots of efforts. And I think this is kind of, you know, we had the carpet bombing of television channels. And now I just, you know, hear often from you or one of my other colleagues, something that somebody liked, and I just go and order that one thing.
I was listening to a podcast with Netflix's CEO, and he was saying, look, a couple years ago, we tried broad, like, kind of brand Netflix advertising on linear TV, and we spent millions and millions of dollars on it. And then we kind of figured out, like, each person likes their own types of TV shows. Like, what we want to do is we just want to advertise to them specifically with the type of TV shows we're making that they like. So, you know, if you like a dystopian sci-fi type show, we'll just advertise directly to you on Facebook or Google, the companies will advertise directly to you, and that's your Netflix that you're going to get. We don't need to brand build for Netflix and advertise, you know, one of like the kind of older comedies like The Ranch or something. So
my wife and I have a joke back and forth, the internet doesn't know me, where we find uncanny ads that are targeted at us specifically. So it'll be someone, usually attractive young woman on a...
If it's an attractive young woman, the internet knows you.
on a specific model of a truck that I like that's, you know, like 50 years old or something. And I think that's just amazing. How would they come up with that? But I mean, they really can target incredibly specific to the aesthetics and interests. And they know what you're going to want to watch before you do. And their suggestions are often good. And so kind of just paying as a subscription for a channel that you rarely watch, I think is going to be it looks to me like an inventory issue of an incumbent conglomerate that's going to disappear over time.
And you know, just on the pay, like if you're getting a little bit of something from everyone, as in the old cable channel model where you put out VH1-8 and you got paid a little bit of something, quality doesn't matter that much, right? All that matters is you manage to work your way in the network. The cool thing about a Netflix is you're paying them $10 out of your pocket every month directly. That is your choice, not the cable channels kind of negotiating for a broad pack. That encourages Netflix to keep up the quality and keep producing good things. If they stop, you cancel your money. So I think it's much better kind of incentives aligned there as well.
Now, I was reading about this issue coming into our conversation today. And one thing, though, I do think some of it missed was they're saying, oh, these smaller channels by viewership could be in a lot of trouble. There are some that actually have really good revenue. You know, golf is one thing that's always been really good revenue, even though there are a lot of people like me who don't particularly care about golf at all. So that there will be these kind of specific target audiences that have pretty good
But those
revenue.
Are channels that have niches with, you know, very popular, very passionate niche bases.
Yes.
Those are channels that are going to make it because even if they get cut, people are going to find a way to go find them. Whereas something like NBC's Esquire channel, it was just an out there channel that they managed to negotiate into the package. That's something nobody cared about. So I think you need to have something really good quality or good quality that people are really passionate about, and then you can survive in this world. And I think that's increasingly what we see. Anyway, I think that's all the time we have for today. I'll give you last thoughts if you have anything else.
Oh, long writers. I think that we had this really low point of the carpet bombing was kind of reality TV, point a camera at a bunch of people on spring break. And now the best Hollywood writers are going to be super employable in the future that is more bespoke, more targeted.
Oh, Netflix, you know, they're buying more content than anyone's ever seen before. Mm-hmm. And if the quest for great content is Netflix versus HBO versus FX versus a ton of people, you're exactly right. Great writers are going to get paid, and that's going to be great for us, for consumers. The best, they can serve us all with great stories. All right, so let's wrap it up there. That's all the time we have for today. Just before we hit our disclosures, a quick reminder. If you like this podcast, the best way to get more is to recommend us to a friend and get them to start listening. You know, having more listeners really encourages us to keep doing this podcast, keep taping more of them. So we appreciate it to everyone who has been recommending us. Chris, disclosures, none for me. Any for you?
None for me.
Okay, perfect. We'll talk to you guys later this week.